This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers. This week we've got two sponsors, Timeline 3D by BDocs and MindVault, which is a new sponsor for us. It's a text learning application. More information on that application at mindvaultapp.com, and we'll tell you more about both of those as the show goes on. Hey, Bradley, how are you doing today?
We're back and better than ever. First show in 2013. Mm-hmm. Seemed like most of my podcasts took 2 weeks off. So I guess we followed the trend.
Yep. I guess we're getting old and taking holidays. I keep going on about how we're getting old. I don't know what's the thing about that. I guess I'm feeling my own mortality or something. But
Every year. Yeah, I think as you, it's like as your kids get just a bit older, I guess you just start to feel more and more like like our parents did when you're growing up, especially around the holidays when you're, it's really more about my son at this point, because your kids are a little bit older than mine, but my son is two. And so the Christmas morning is spent attaching stickers to toys that you then have to put together.
Mm-hmm.
I would pay good money for toys that come preassembled. I really don't even like my ideal toy. My son is obsessed with Thomas the Train. So my ideal toys are not big toys, but not necessarily small toys that are lost easily. So I like medium sized toys that are self contained. So they don't have a lot of pieces. Maybe they come in the box and you just wheel that. Maybe it's a truck that has the stickers already together and you just wheel it out. Again, that's, if the world revolved around me, that's the kind of toys my son would have. But he does not. He has a lot of little cars and things like that.
Well, we hit the we crossed that line this year. So my oldest daughter, who's 8, she got Lego this year. And this was the year where I was only called upon for advice, but I wasn't allowed to actually build the Lego. And I got into some trouble because I started helping build the Lego, and then I got a bit carried away and built the whole thing. And I wanted to do that was the complaint. So lesson learned for me as well.
Yeah, Legos can be complicated. I've heard Mike Curley over at the 70 Decibels Podcast Network, him and Stephen Hackett have been talking about putting together some big Star Wars Lego sets. And that's like a whole, the licensing of the Legos, of movie franchises, apparently is a big deal now.
Yeah, it's turned into a definite thing. April got some of the Lego Friends stuff, which is that set of Lego that's kind of been derided as Lego for girls. But what can you do?
Yeah, we're in the wrong business, apparently. We should be creating something like that. It's printing money, basically.
Well, apparently, just to wrap up some Lego chat, I saw some news today that there's a new Lego Mindstorms kit coming out that's controllable from the iPhone, which I don't think has been possible before, at least not with straight out of the box. So I guess now I have my final excuse to go ahead and buy some Lego for school and see what I can put together with that.
Well, that's always the key. Try to figure out how you can expense your toys. That's always the key. No, I'm kidding. Not that anybody may or may not be interested. We've talked about it on previous shows, but I have a contract on my house. So I will be moving in T-minus 1 month. We do not know where we're moving, so that's a challenge. But I will be packing quite a bit. That'll be fun.
It's interesting you should say that, because one of the things that I've done over the Christmas holidays is I moved. My home office has been taken over because we're expecting another baby next month, so that has become the new baby's room. And my desk is now in the family room, and the adjustment has been killing me. I used to have a room where I could go in and I could close the door and all of this stuff, and now there are children at my desk all the time. And my sanity is on the edge of holding together. But as a result of that, one of the things I did over Christmas was I ordered a new laptop, because my 27-inch iMac and having it all in the front room and so on was difficult. So I've decided to, I guess, a kind of early theme for 2013 has been sell everything you own and buy a smaller version of it that can pack into your backpack that you can hide from the children. And that's my mantra for this year. Small things.
Yeah, we have a really great space for our iPads and our iPhones in our current house. Our fireplace has a mantle above it, and then it has outlets on top of that. So we have chargers running behind picture frames that are set up there, kind of freestanding.
Okay.
And then that's where we charge, and that's where our iOS devices sit. So out of reach of small grimy hands.
Well, see, I don't even have that luxury anymore, because my oldest could reach it, and my youngest daughter, she knows how to use the chair now. and they tend to team up on you as well. So it's a bit like the Gremlins now, you know, you've got no hope of winning.
Yeah, that's true. I guess before we kind of move into today's topic, let's talk about our first sponsor. BDoc's Timeline 3D has been a great sponsor for the show. Even if you don't have a need for the apps, drop them a line on their website. Tell them you appreciate them sponsoring the show. The show does have actual real costs that we have to pay, so the sponsors help offset that. So they've been a great sponsor for us. And we ran a contest a few weeks ago. Wanted to hear a story about how somebody has used timelines to engage students. Didn't have to be with Timeline 3D. It could be even with a piece of cardboard and a pencil. So we want to talk about that story, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the app. So the story we got was pretty cool. I'm just going to read a quick little bit of it. It says, I teach high school science at a small school in western Missouri. I've used Timeline 3D for Mac since it came out. I'm pretty sure I used the program before the 3D part of it, but I can't remember. On my computer, and now I've moved to the iPad through conversion to Keynote, are several history of such as the history of chemistry, oxygen, timeline, history of the atom, and of the periodic table. I'm currently working on a tree of life timeline for zoology. I've used the program to present to faculty the things such as history of the internet and others. It always impresses, and I get a few oohs and ahs. I haven't tried the iPad version yet, but I will soon. Thanks for a great program and providing educational discounts. So that's pretty cool. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about how even Keynote, especially PowerPoint, they're kind of tried and true, and people are almost bored with them. So timelines are a great way to even just do presentations in your faculty meetings. So BDoc's Timeline 3D, they have a Mac and an iOS version. It lets students and teachers create and present timelines on the iPads, iPhones, and iPod touches. So again, great ways for talking about historical contexts. The timelines begin as traditional 2D charts, and then you can shift to a 3D flyover with a click of a button. Users can view and interact with timelines on their devices, and timelines can be presented to larger groups using AirPlay or by connecting a display or projector. Timeline 3D is the most simple way to make beautiful multimedia timelines. It's available on the App Store for $14.99 for the iOS version. And again, you can buy the Mac version at bdocs.com. Again, it's a great program. It's dead simple to use. It's one of those apps that you'll get for the iPhone or the iPad. You'll do something great in about 30 minutes, and people will think you're a programmer. So again, thanks for the guys over at BDocs for sponsoring the show. You can check them out at bdocs.com. That's BEEDOCS.com.
Superb. Okay, so our big topic for today is AV systems. We're going to talk a little bit about various types of setups that you can build, both fixed setups and portable setups. And of course, the sort of 800-pound gorilla these days is Apple TV, which has kind of come in from the low end. And I guess, you know, disrupted was the buzzword of 2012, I think, right? And I don't want to overplay these phrases, but I think really and truly, if you look at the way that we're going to talk about these topics today versus the sort of orthodoxy that held for the last 10 years about how much money you would spend on interactive whiteboards and integrated projectors and so on, it's really been a sea change of using much lighter and simpler technology at times to get the job done. So Bradley, you want to tell us a little bit about what you're thinking on EV?
Well, currently we're kind of in a weird spot. We've not had the resources to do something school-wide, so we've kind of done things together piecemeal. We get what's called E-rate funding and Title I funding from the state. Even though we're a private school, we still do receive some of those funds, and so we usually will buy various little, not gadgets, but little small things for various classrooms that we feel like have the need. And so probably about a third of our classrooms are still using the old overhead projectors, which, you know, if you guys have probably seen those, you have to print off special transparency paper. They're very bright and they're hot, and this is before even projectors, and so we've still got some of those floating around. And then, you know, the kind of the mid transition for us are the, you know, projectors plus document cameras. You know, Elmo is one brand and Mimio is another. Have you guys dabbled with those at all?
No, we never have. We jumped straight from overhead projectors to digital projectors. I guess maybe about, well, when we got our new building, which was 5 or 6 years ago now. And we did look at, when we first got the iPad, and the iPad 1 obviously doesn't support much projection capability apart from Keynote and the videos and photos apps. We looked at buying some document projectors, and it was one of those situations where it was a total judgment call, because people were desperate to have the ability to see the iPad screen on the big screen. But I really felt that it was blindingly obvious that something was going to have to change with that quite soon. And obviously the iPad 2 came out a year later and had display mirroring capability. So we held off on that and got lucky, I think.
Well, and, you know, kind of talking about projectors, I kind of like projectors like I like printers. There's really nothing redeeming about them. They're complicated to use. They're expensive. Then the bulbs seem to go out every year, depending on how bad the brand is and how they're used. And just looking forward, it does seem like the ideal way to go is a big TV and an Apple TV, especially if you're moving to iOS.
I agree. I mean, HDMI has kind of come on to be something that connects to things other than DVD players recently. You know, we started looking at TVs about a year ago. There's a link in the show notes to an article that I wrote back in March of, I think it was March 2011, actually, talking about, it was called the Next Generation Classroom AV System, and that was our first experiment, and that was not long after the first Apple TV came out. So we got one Apple TV, we had a new style unibody Mac Mini, the kind that has an HDMI port on the back, and we got ourselves one 40-inch Sony TV, and we tried that out, and it worked pretty well. For the price, you know, you add up the price of all of those components, and actually you've spent less than one interactive whiteboard, not even counting the projector you would need to work with that. We've learned a few things about that in the meantime, which we'll talk about, I guess, as we go on. But that has been, those systems have been successful. We haven't yet rolled it out across the whole school. We've actually done the Apple TV first, and the displays will probably come later as prices come down for all those panels. But yeah, certainly when you're an iOS-centric school the way we are, then Apple TV is a pretty powerful way to go.
Now, if you're not a one-to-one school, I really do like the Elmo digital document projectors. And, of course, Mimio, again, is another brand. But if you've never used those, so take about what you know about overhead projectors, where a teacher would have to print something off on special paper. The Elmo, basically, you can put anything under there, and it will display, and it's pretty clear. Again, it needs to be tied to a projector. So, you know, if you're going to spend, I don't know, $400 on a mid-range projector, the Elmo document cameras, depending on what model you get, are also around $500. So you've got $900 in it. But again, if you're not a full, you know, if you don't have a classroom full of iPads yet, it's a kind of a good stopgap for you because it's very useful. It's very easy for the teachers to use. The document part of it is, we'll talk about the frustration of using projectors, I guess, later, but they're fairly easy to use.
Yeah, these document cameras are, it's important not to forget that there are other uses for it other than showing something digital. I mean, our scientists would really like to have one just to show very small things on the big screen, you know, little samples, insects, whatever kind of things, slides, connecting it to a microscope or whatever you can do with these things. I'm interested in probably getting one at some point, but maybe one for the whole school rather than kitting out every classroom with one. But there are definitely other applications. And when we were looking into document cameras, I was really impressed with how sophisticated they were. You know, okay, the sophisticated ones were on the order of about £800. But they could do things. They had zooming in them. You could freeze frame them. You could split frame them and various things. And they were pretty powerful in themselves. They worked okay with the, even if you put an iPad under it or some backlit source, they were okay. They struggled, most of them with the auto exposure, struggled a little bit when your hand came over the screen and then the brightness would dramatically change between the brightness of the screen and the darkness of your hand on top. But we found them to be interesting, but also quite expensive, and we're still not totally sure how we would put them into practice across the school.
You know, we run into that with a lot of things. It's great, or that'll work great, but then when you look at deploying it school-wide, you look at the cost and then, you know, kind of the logistics of it, it changes things. You know, if you're doing something, you know, for a conference room, oh, that's not that expensive. But, you know, if it's, you know, $1,000 setup, by the time you do it for 30 classrooms, well, that's a $30,000 project.
Yeah, these numbers do add up. And I guess the beauty of some of these systems is that they can collapse down into, say, a briefcase kind of size. So you can take some of them around. Others are much more designed to be built onto a desk or left on a workbench or something in a lab and not moved around. But there are other ones you can get which are equally powerful. They're just built in such a way that the stand collapses and so on, and you can take them around.
Well, speaking of, you know, kind of portable, we've actually, we have a handful of Promethean boards, but those are the digital whiteboards. And I have a lot of complaints about them. They're not bad. Smart is another competitor of theirs. And we've got two of their portable boards. And I say portable specifically because they're portable but not necessarily mobile. Because we actually have pretty much an all female faculty. And so when the teachers try to roll it from room to room, it's often pretty heavy. And so that's something to consider if you are looking at, you know, digital whiteboards that are, you know, on wheels. How heavy are they? Can your teachers actually move them?
Yeah, and how big are they as well? You know, some of the situations you get into with portable equipment in schools is that you've got to move them during a period, for example, where there's nobody moving about the corridor because you need most of the corridor and people to hold the doors open for you and stuff as well. It's all about these practicalities.
Yeah, again, it's day to day. How does it work? And what happens with a lot of that, if you don't consider, you know, not being able to move it but between periods, and it becomes a big hassle, then teachers will just stop using it, and then you've just wasted your money.
Yeah, that's the beauty of doing something that's built into the classroom, is that the teacher could just show up and it's there and it's ready to go. And that's a way that we have kind of moved over the past year. We used to have things like portable speaker kits, where teachers could take a set of powered speakers with them to various classrooms. And we just decided that instead of doing that, because we ended up with like different generations of the product, so that the power adapters for one generation didn't work with the next generation and so on. So we said, stop, let's just put one set of speakers in every classroom and therefore nobody has to move them. And that kind of went along with the Apple TV deployment that we did as well, to the point where you can pretty much walk up to any classroom in our school. Not every classroom, there's still one or two that don't have Apple TV yet, but pretty much every classroom in the school, you can walk up and just connect over AirPlay to the screen, or using VGA, depending, and that will work.
Yeah, you know, it'll especially be interesting if Apple eventually does release a television that basically has the Apple TV functionality built in. You've gotten rid of an additional piece.
Yeah, I mean, if the two ever come together, that's going to be a win. I remain highly skeptical that Apple are building a television panel, but, you know, one never knows.
Well, and what we've done, we've talked about this in the past, if you aren't going to use Apple TVs in the classroom, but you, let's say you wanted to mount the TV on the wall, one of the things we have done, which is a very, very low budget option, is you can buy industrial strength Velcro on Amazon for just a few dollars. And then the Apple TV is so light, you can attach it to the back of it. And so that's worked very well for us. Again, they do sell specific mounts, but, you know, if you're looking at trying to do 30 classrooms with TVs and Apple TVs, if you can save, you know, $30 on a mount times 30, that adds up.
Yeah. You mentioned industrial strength Velcro. I do this all the time, and I've ruined so many walls in the school by doing this, but I always buy the strongest possible Velcro that one can buy. And what I have done several times is when you mount the Apple TV to the wall, if you ever need to take it off again, real industrial strength Velcro, it tends to be that the Velcro connection is actually stronger than the wall that the glue is connected to. And more than once I have tried to take the Apple TV off the wall and pull the paint surface off the wall as well. So my advice would perhaps be not to get the industrial strength Velcro, but just to get the regular strength Velcro. And save your paintwork, or at least stick it on something that's painted gloss, piece of wood or something, rather than what I stupidly did in one classroom, was just stick it right to the drywall.
Yeah, I'm sure your maintenance man really appreciated that call.
Yeah, I placed a poster over it.
Yeah, good. That's even better. Now, like, in the classrooms that you have Apple TVs, did you run Cat 5 or did you run, are you just doing Wi-Fi off of those?
All our Apple TVs, apart from one, are still on Wi-Fi. That's worked okay. I do have a kind of to-do to perhaps look at putting more of them onto Ethernet, but so far so good with the Wi-Fi for the most part.
Yeah, that should work fine. I'm kind of the opinion that something is stationary, it's always nice to be able to run an Ethernet cord to it. Obviously, 802.11n is wonderful and it's great speed, but, if you have an interference issue intermittently, it's just nice to be able to plug it in, especially because it's stationary.
Yeah, I think it's one of these things that anything you can do to take the load off, you might as well do, because it's just running another cable. And as long as the position you've put the device in is not too difficult, and in our case, none of them are very difficult, it's just that I haven't done it yet, I think that's definitely worth doing.
Do you want to complain about projectors now?
I have a love-hate relationship with projectors, much like you do. I mean, the biggest problem I have with projectors is that it's really, the numbers and the models change so often that it's hard to find a good brand. That's been my frustration for years, is that the projector that I bought a year ago, there's a completely different one out now. It's not like the iMac where, there's been an iMac for 10 years and whatever one you get is usually a good one. It's just a bit better every year. It's like, oh, here's another thing I've got to learn new. So I guess, my strong recommendation with projectors is buy all 20 that you need at the one time, and better the one devil you know than the five devils you don't know, We've had various projectors. Some have been absolutely perfect. In-focus projectors that we've bought have been great. They've worked for... Some of them are 5 or 6 years old now and they're working perfectly. We've bought other ones from BenQ, which haven't worked since the first day we got them, or at least not worked properly. And we did discover when we deployed our Apple TVs, we used the Canex Pro HDMI to VGA adapter on most of our classrooms, and we didn't put TVs in, we just connected them to projectors. And we found one or two projectors that couldn't handle that kind of resolution. And they were only handling sort of 640 by 480 resolution, and we had to actually swap out a couple for newer projectors. And sad to say, one of those was a Sony projector, which was otherwise a really nice one, except that it was just its actual internal brains were not that good, even though the optics and the bulb and everything were fine. But in terms of the classroom and actual the impact on teaching and learning, I think is important to consider as well. The complaint I've always had with projectors is just the fan noise. And certainly if you have it on a table, the heat that it produces and blasts over one poor pupil in the class who just gets put straight to sleep by the soporific noise and the heat that's waving over them as well. Now, obviously, if you have those projectors mounted in the classroom, you're going to have them up on the ceiling or in a position on the shelf or something where they're at least out of the way. People are out of the way of the exhaust blast of these things. But I guess that's my main complaint, noise. And also... Well, in the Scottish winter, it's not too much of a problem, but in the Scottish summer, it is a problem, is keeping the daylight out of the classroom, because that's another thing that can send kids to sleep pretty much straight away, is, you've come back from lunch, it's warm, it's getting warmer as the projector's on, the room is kind of darkened down, you're listening to a teacher talk, and suddenly you just fall asleep. And I have myself fallen asleep in class while while showing things on a projector after lunch. So if the teacher can't even stay awake, then how can the kids stay awake?
Yeah, you kind of nailed my complaints as well. It is frustrating how there's 1,000 different model numbers, and it's also hard to find parts as well. We had a Dell projector last year. We've got, 1,000 different models. Every one we have is a different model. We've got Epsons, we've got InFocuses, we've got Dells. And so I had a Dell projector that got pulled off of a cart, and it did not work. Well, it worked, but just like the color was off. So I did a little research and discovered it's probably the color wheel. So I thought, oh, that's great. I can just buy a new one and fix it, right? No, because you can't buy them anywhere. That's, again, another frustration. You can't really buy any parts. Like, I can't even go to Dell's website and buy that particular part. So I had to go to this website called AliExpress.com, A-L-I-Express.com. and basically buy the part from China. Well, that wasn't too bad. It was like $80, which is not cheap, but it's better than buying a $400 projector that was still fairly new, because I knew I could replace it pretty easily. Well, the downside about it being from China is it took like 8 calls to my credit card company to get them to let it go through. I was trying to use our corporate card at first, and I don't have access to call. So I just said, forget it. I'm just going to use my personal card, and I would just get reimbursed later. So it literally took – couldn't use American Express. I love American Express. But trying to buy something overseas with them is nearly impossible because their fraud detection is so strong, they just cancel the charges. They don't. It's not that they let them through and then call you. They just like – they cancel the charge and then call you. So it's very frustrating. So just ended up buying it on a personal card. Finally got it in a couple weeks later and fixed it. But that's a frustration. It's just, you know, again, you can't get parts for them. Everything, again, it's a different model number. There's one number different. You don't know, does this bulb go with that projector? I'm not 100% sure. Bulb replacement, you know, kind of feels expensive. Again, a good one, depending on how often it's used, will last you definitely a few years. But if the teacher has a bad habit of turning it on and off, like after every, little short lesson, then that's going to obviously wear it because it strikes the bulb. Mm-hmm. It's also kind of hard to know what's a good projector. You know, what are lumens? I don't know. There's no like training class. I don't even know what lumens are and how that affects what I'm trying to do. That, you know, it's kind of complicated.
Yeah. There's also a tension there between, in the UK is ruled by health and safety regulations, but there are regulations about light sources in the classroom and things like that. And where if you can't mount it necessarily right out of the eye line of the teacher, then there are certain limits, I believe, or at least I have been told that this is the case, limits to how bright a light you can put facing somebody working. So obviously there's a real tension there between you want the brightest possible bulb in order to overcome the ambient light in the classroom, particularly if you can't black out the classroom. And then there's this limit of, you know, how bright a light can you force people to sort of stare into while they work. So that's another kind of problem as well, is there's this tension between the ambient light and the brightness and the safety thereof. So you're right, it's tricky. And finding, you know, when you go into Amazon.com, for example, there's 35 different projectors and there's various numbers you can measure them by, but I don't know if you found this, but I've always found that it's not that you buy a projector to be bright and it turns out not to be bright that's the problem, but you buy a projector, it's as bright as advertised, but for some unexplained reason, it just won't talk to something that you want to connect to it. And it's actually the kind of the reliability of the guts of these things is sometimes in a bit of question as well.
Well, and then then the connectors are kind of weak and stuff that comes unplugged all the time. If a student bumps into it, then if it's not ceiling mounted, then it comes unplugged and it starts searching for signal and they plug it back up, but it's on the wrong cycle. So it's already passed it. So then the teacher thinks it's messed up. So they unplug it again. And it's like, it's just impossible to get it reconnected. And again, I don't know if lumens are like megapixels where after like a certain point, it kind of doesn't matter. Like I don't need one that's good for like 3D television. I just need ones. Like I just need one that says like, this will be good for your school. Like I don't need all, it's very,
yeah.
Very, and I guess this is how like regular people feel about buying computers when they say, I don't understand what the RPMs of a drive means. And I can say, well, you don't need the 10,000, but probably good to have 72. That must be how regular people feel because buying projectors is terrifying.
Yeah, and no matter how much research you do, because this is one of the other things with so many model numbers, it's hard to do research because each model has like 0 to 1 reviews on any review site. It's not like there are typically models where, you know, this is the one that everybody gets. You know, it's like, well, I get this one and I get that one. And we all bought them because they were the cheapest one on Amazon at the time we needed their projector. You know, because the good ones are so expensive compared to the very, very basic ones that we tend to buy. That's a difficulty as well as just knowing beforehand.
It's like refrigerators. There's like 1,000 of them. LG will release 45, refrigerators this year alone. I just don't know why these companies just don't build like 3, like kind of take the Apple approach and build 3 really good ones and get really good at those.
You know that there's now a refrigerator that runs Evernote.
I did hear that. I want a watch with Evernote. Imagine if you could have a watch with a camera in it. Everything runs Evernote now. It's great.
Yeah. We live in a strange feature.
But is it running Android?
I do not know. I guess so. Maybe it's running that Tizen operating system. That's the first Tizen product.
You know, it's funny. Like I kind of have mixed feelings about the connected home. Kind of a side note, like I bought some Belkin Wemos over Christmas, those little internet-connected power outlets, and they were great for like a day. And then I'll put a link on my blog about the review I had. And like they were great, but then they quit working like the next day, and they were kind of like the device was on, and it said it was off, and it was kind of out of sync. And I just have no patience for like technology in my home that doesn't work. Like just when it's like an appliance type thing, like I just, with a power outlet, you just expect it to work. And it's same thing with a refrigerator. The last thing I want to do is like to be having to do firmware upgrades on my refrigerator. So it's like, I want technology in the home, but I need it to be near flawless.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because that's a large part of people's experience with AV systems as well, isn't it? That, you know, you go to a holiday house or something and there's an AV system in there and it's got a DVD player and it's got a cable TV box and whatever else, you know, and there's four remote controls, each with 90 buttons on it. And the only way you can figure out is by matching the brand and the remote control to the brand of the unit on. And then you go to a really nice place and they've got all Sony gear and there's four Sony remote controls and goodness knows which one does which. And of course, now with the connected home and smart TVs and stuff, you're going to get into firmware updates for TVs as well. That's something that we've got two Sony TVs in school at the moment, and some of those have got various features that let you do things like connect. There's an Ethernet jack in the back of the TVs, and you can watch BBC iPlayer directly on the TV without having to, you know, stream it through an iPad or something first. These things are getting rather complicated, you know, that's a source of potential problems as well. But I think the simplest thing I've always looked for when we've looked at TVs is just, can I get one that's got two or three HDMI inputs, and I'll just use it as a dumb, stupid HDMI monitor, and we'll connect HDMI things to it. Number one, of course, being Apple TV. Number two being the HDMI adapter for iPads. And of course, now the Retina display MacBook Pros are carrying an HDMI port on the side as well. So that's quite a useful simplification and unification. So we're maybe starting to see possibly the end of VGA, at least for controlled environments like the school that you work in. Of course, VGA is never going to go away as a standard for people who are coming into situations where they haven't been before. Everybody's going to still provide VGA for visiting speakers, but HDMI may, it looks like, become the new VGA, which would be very nice.
Yeah, it seems like all the TV makers are kind of worried about becoming just a dumb panel, and so they're building in all the smart features. My wife's father purchased a 70-inch Vizio off Amazon, no less, over Christmas, and it's actually got a full QWERTY keyboard on the back. I guess it works okay, but it's just like they just like cram everything into the television. But what's funny is he doesn't use like any of the Netflix or the Amazon features. He's got an Apple TV that he uses, and I did show him AirPlay over Christmas, and he was amazed by it. He has an iPad, but going back to sound, like AV systems, he had a really nice, I think it was an Onkyo 5.1 home theater in a box system, but it was so complicated, he just unplugged it and went back to the regular sound on his television, because he never could get it on the right input. And so I think that's just as these kind of connected homes grow and the connected classrooms, mm-hmm. it's how do you make it more advanced, but like keep regular people in the loop on how to use it. If they can't figure, that's what's great about the Apple TV, because it's, you know, it's kind of simple. If you can at least get on the right input, you can manage it. But some of these like intertwined systems are highly complicated.
Yeah, and then somebody's going to ask you, of course, how are you implementing e-safety on your televisions? And at that point, I'll just resign and retire, I think.
Yeah.
But it's an issue, right? And I think, I guess that the beauty is that, you know, as you go over IP networks, everything that goes over HTTP is going to take your filtering, you know, so there is that too as well. But increasingly, you know, I had this conversation on Friday. I was visiting a school down in the south of England, and we were talking about, they had a situation where their network login system was based on a captive portal page. So you'd get an interstitial HTML page, and then you had to log into that through a browser and then go and do the thing you wanted to do. And they had just rolled out 300 odd iPads to their staff. And a lot of staff were getting very confused because their device's first hit on the network is typically no longer through a traditional web browser. So these people were opening up, you know, Evernote or Twitter clients or something, and they were getting nothing back. And people were very confused by why was that. And the reason was because instead of getting an XML response from a web server or a web service, they were being fed an HTML page, and the application couldn't understand that response from the server. So it looked like an error. It wasn't actually an error. It was just that they were being captured into this HTML page. And I guess, you know, TVs are going to be victims of that as well. As time goes on, you know, if they don't have reasonably full web browsers, that's going to be difficult for people to get connected to networks. And that's certainly something that affects the Apple TV as well. Even leaving aside the TV panel, I've helped a number of people. Well, I haven't helped them because I don't have a solution to the problem, but apart from fix your network. But people have talked to me and asked me questions about, we need to log into a web page before we can get this device onto the network, and it's an Apple TV. And the Apple TV doesn't have any browser built into it that you would call a browser. Therefore, they couldn't get their Apple TV authenticated to the network and out onto the internet to activate it and do whatever else they wanted to do. So these network design problems are also just going to be more and more of a problem as more we move into this connected home, connected classroom, Internet of Things kind of world, where not every network device that you connect has got a web browser on it. People are going to have to think a bit more about the way they do authentication and authorization on their networks, and can't just always rely on there being a full HTML browser there to do the authentication part before people can get on the network and do the thing.
I did very much despise captive web portals. I very much do. The only place I've seen it done really well here in the States is Target, which is a kind of a big box retailer. They're when you connect, like as soon as if I walk into the store right now, my phone reconnects, and before it does anything, like immediately brings up a splash page, even before I can click on an icon, asking me to connect, and it can do that very, it does it very fast somehow. But with the captive web portals that basically just wait till you go to Safari, that just doesn't work in an age where devices are not built around a browser.
Yeah.
My final thing about projectors before we move on from that, the turnoff procedure. So the way this works, I'm showing a teacher how to use a projector, and I say, okay, here's the power button. So she looks at that, and I press it. Then I say, look up at the screen. And she looks up at the screen, and I said, you see where it says to turn off, press off again? So you press off again. Who thought of that? Just make it where it's like one click. I mean, I realized the design of it was so people didn't accidentally turn it off, because, again, that turning on and off a projector is what causes the bulb to go out. But, I mean, who thought that was a good idea? And why are we still doing that in 2013?
Yeah, I guess it's also because the latency time between turning off and being able to turn it back on again can be like 5 minutes or more. And if you accidentally bump it off, then you're sitting around for 5 minutes waiting for it to come back on.
Do not know why that's a problem in 2013. I feel like the technology should advance where a projector can be turned on and off. I mean, maybe not, but like, why do you have to wait 5 minutes for it to cool down?
These bulbs are fragile and fancy things, aren't they?
Oh, lots of complaints. second sponsor, MindVault is your mm-hmm. personal memorization assistant. It allows you to memorize any passage of text. It's an app by a guy named Noah Reed. Noah is pretty active on Twitter and app.net. Already updated for iOS 6, which, again, that's kind of my litmus test for an app now. Is if it's already updated for the iPhone 5 in the taller screen, then I know they're a committed developer. So a couple of things you can use this for: memorizing lines from any play. So if you got if you're a music teacher and you're preparing for a play, it's a great thing to do it for. Obviously, studying for a test, a poem or a love song, quotes from someone you admire, debate material, scriptures, wedding vows. Again, if you're studying for a certification exam, you can plug things in here. You memorize things. Memorizing things focuses the mind and improves your ability to retain what matters. You get started by entering the passage you want to memorize into MindVault, and then use the slider to let it test you as you recite the passage. Pretty soon, using Mind Vault, you will have everything in your head, and you can store the passage in the vault for later reference. It's available for the iPhone, iPod Touch, and the iPad. Buy it on the App Store, or you can find out more at mindvaultapp.com. And we'll have a link to this in the show notes as well. But it's a pretty cool app. This is, again, this is highly relevant for your students as well, because there's a lot of memorizing in school. And so it's a great app to check out. Just a couple of bucks. Again, check it out at mindvaultapp.com. Thanks again to Noah for sponsoring the show this week.
Awesome. So we've kind of, I guess we've talked a lot about Apple TV all the way through the show so far, but I guess we just want to wrap up by talking a little bit about the specific move away from projectors and fan and bulb-based technologies towards, I guess really towards televisions, but connected to AirPlay as well. We've done a little bit of that, as I've said. We've done two 40-inch Sony TVs in our classroom so far. We've kind of held off doing any more of that, though, because, I mean, well, let me step back and say what it was that made me think about doing this in the first place. It was, of course, all this dissatisfaction with projectors that we've talked about. But there were three things, really, that really motivated me to look at televisions. And one was that the price was just coming down. You know, flat-screen televisions are getting thinner and lighter and cheaper all the time. And the prices are coming down a bit more dramatically now that all the early adopters have bought one and the manufacturers are having to do a bit more work to get people to switch to or even upgrade to a newer flat-screen television. The second thing is that the lifespan of a flat-screen panel is substantially greater than the lifespan of a projector bulb. Based on some numbers that I looked at, you can expect maybe 3,000 hours of operation with a projector bulb. But don't forget, that's also declining hours of operation all the time. So from the day you turn it on, the performance is getting gradually worse and worse and worse. And of course, you don't really see that because, you know, it's like a room getting darker as you read. You're using it every day. It just gets a tiny fraction less bright, less saturated colors all the time, until you're using this terrible thing and you can't even tell it is terrible because you haven't looked at a new projector recently. So a flat screen panel can typically expect 15 to 25,000 hours of operation, possibly more for good quality panels at full power. The backlight may obviously decline a little bit, but you'll get a much longer lifespan. So we were looking at them for about the same cost as a projector. We could buy about a 40-inch television and get a much longer life with it as well. In addition, the TV typically doesn't have a fan in it, so you lose that soporific background noise, which will keep some more students awake. And of course, you don't have to black out the classroom. You can just keep the lights on, keep the blinds up, and you can use your television, except in, of course, the most direct sunlight, which of course we never get in Scotland because it's cloudy all the time. So direct sunlight would be a lovely problem to have if we ever got it, but it tends not to be our biggest problem. And I guess finally also the other thing that's nice about Apple, not Apple TV, but TVs in general, is that it's an integrated audio and video system, because we talk about projectors and so on, that's only the video part of it. Some projectors obviously carry through audio as well, but for the most part, if you're bringing an iPad to a projector, or a Mac to a projector for that matter, you're going to plug in the video cable and you're going to plug in the headphone jack as well and play that through some other system. And what that you end up with, almost like you're teaching from inside an intensive care bed, you know, there's cables and wires running everywhere and you really can't move. So the beauty of HDMI or AirPlay is that you carry the audio and the video over the same channel, and therefore you have, and typically TVs have pretty loud speakers in them as well, so you have nice, reasonably high fidelity audio all integrated into this one box. It doesn't have a fan, doesn't require a darkened room, and lasts a whole lot longer for the same amount of money. So those were all the upsides of going to a TV panel. The biggest downside we ran into, two downsides, was one, a 40-inch TV is really not big enough for a reasonably sized classroom. Now, we have some pretty small classrooms in our school, and for those classrooms, 40-inch TV is absolutely fine. But for the bigger classrooms, the kids who were sitting at the furthest point from the TV were really struggling to see what was going on, and we ended up having to sort of, you know, bring all your chairs closer to the screen so you can see it sort of thing, and then go back to your desks, which is far from ideal. So that was why we stuck with projectors for some of the bigger classrooms now, and we redeployed the TVs to the smaller rooms. Now, as time goes on and you know, the 70-inch TV you just mentioned becomes the new normal, that problem may go away. The other issue was when you AirPlay with an iPad, because you're projecting a sort of squarish aspect ratio from the iPad, you kind of get these pillar boxes at the side, you know, these black bars, where you lose a part of the TV panel that really doesn't get used when you're showing an iPad screen. So that further reduced the kind of effective size of the display for people in the back of the classroom. So that was something to bear in mind as well. So we're thinking nowadays that probably 60-plus inch television is the size you want to do for a big classroom. Either that, or have some mechanism of repeating the display halfway up the room, so that there's maybe another TV on the wall halfway up the classroom, so that nobody's ever that far away from a display. And of course, there's HDMI repeaters and things that you can use to make that possible as well. I've seen a friend of mine has works in a school down in England, and he has a system where hanging from the ceiling, he's got a kind of three-way mount for televisions. So he's got three panels all, you know, one third of a circle away from each other. And that hangs in the center of the classroom, and it has an Apple TV in it as well. So the teacher can share their iPad screen to that tree of TVs, if you like, and the classroom kind of built around that, and anybody is pretty much the same distance away from it. And that's obviously a very fancy solution, but it's quite an effective one if you have the resources and the space to build that kind of thing as well. So I think TVs are on the way. I don't think it's not a slam dunk obvious choice right now, just because of where we are with the cost of panels and the cost of TVs and the size of them and so on. But I think as manufacturers just go crazy for making bigger and bigger TVs, you know, it's all to the good because the prices are going to just keep coming down.
Yeah, I think we bought that 70-inch. It was a Vizio, which is not a top-tier brand, but it's certainly not a low-tier. It was $18.99 from Amazon. And mm-hmm. So, you know, if you could get that down, once that kind of trickles down more towards maybe the 1200 range, then the 65-inch will obviously come down. Of course, my local Costco actually has an 80-inch LED. Now, it's about $4,000, but it's a big television.
I've seen one of them before in a conference room somewhere in California, and it was a thing to behold. It really was. It pretty much took up the whole wall. It was quite fantastic.
Wouldn't want to be the guy that has to mount those.
No, you want to pay the extra £5 for installation on that one, I think.
Yeah, the Apple TV really has come a long way. Apple has started building in some more management techniques into it. You can now configure it over Apple Configurator. So, again, there's really no applications for it, but you can go, if you use 802.x authentication for your Wi-Fi, previously the Apple TV could not basically sign onto the network. Well, now you can kind of pre-configure it out of the box. And so it actually, you know, especially if we do end up seeing some applications, it'll be great to see some more kind of mass deployment techniques where you could say even, you know, mass, you know, what you, you know, you could say set the screensaver from Apple Configurator. You could set, you know, because one of the cool things I love about the Apple TV that I discovered over the holidays is in the parental controls, you can turn off the apps that you don't use. So we only really use the built-in ones from Apple, you know, the iTunes store and the computer and the settings, and we use Hulu Plus and Netflix. Well, the rest of them, the Vimeo, the radio, we don't even use those, so we just turn them off. So, you know, being able to do all that from Configurator would be much appreciated.
Yeah, and of course, since we sort of started the podcast and started talking about Apple TV and so on, there are a couple of new features as well. There's been, for a long time, there's been an AirPlay password that you can set so that when you try and connect to a device, to an Apple TV, you're prompted for a password on the device. Now, that's fine, and the way that works is that your iPad will remember the password for the next time so that you always have access to that device until the owner changes the password on the TV. But there's also now a feature with iOS 6 and the latest Apple TV firmware where you can request an on-screen code. And this is a randomly generated one-time number. And what happens is when you request to connect the TV, you're prompted to type in this PIN code on your iPad, but the PIN code you have to type in is generated by the TV and shown on the screen. And this is kind of in response to a problem that some people have had using these in schools, where people somewhere else on the network, possibly in another, even another building or another classroom, could essentially mount attacks on a classroom by sending things appropriate and non-appropriate to certain classroom televisions. So with the on-screen code, at least you have to mount that attack from within the classroom, or at least peeking through the window from the outside. So that's a new feature in iOS 6 and Apple TV latest firmware that's really helped put people's minds at rest. It's not belt and braces security with the authentication and authorization and so on, but it's just a simple social thing that, you know, means that somebody has to have sight of the screen before they can connect to the screen themselves. So that simplifies things quite a lot for people using them in busy schools where, you know, even just with, I'm not even necessarily saying malicious intent, but just accidentally picking the wrong Apple TV from the list. The only person in my school that's done that is actually me. I have done that more than once because I'm clumsy and silly. But that's very useful because it gives you a kind of precaution, if you like, an interlock before you get to get access to that television.
Yeah, that's an interesting problem to try to solve because, you know, on one hand, I'd love to see a way to say, okay, this iPad is the master iPad for this Apple TV, and before anybody can AirPlay to it, you know, like some sort of like app, like Apple TV control app, and it's running, and when people request AirPlay, it'll say, Jimmy Sue's iPad would like to mirror, you know, their screen, and you can accept or deny. But then there's all kinds of issues with that, like what if that iPad breaks, you know, do you have to reset it? And there's, you know, just something where even inside a classroom, you could kind of, I don't know, have a little bit more flexibility.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that Apple TV works at the moment is that the last person to request connection to the TV wins. So if you're on the Apple TV and then I request to get on the Apple TV, I will basically kick you off. Now, I think if there's one simple change that could be made for that, it would be that if I'm using the Apple TV, I have to relinquish control of the TV before somebody else can connect. So you couldn't be preempted off the TV. And that is kind of one way that, you know, if the teacher's taking over the TV for a 30-minute video, nobody else is going to accidentally break into that AirPlay session and cause it to stop and have to be restarted. So that's one way that, you know, without necessarily getting into a big infrastructure thing, if that rule was just changed a little bit, or perhaps optionally changed, then it would be much easier to be confident that once I've got control of a TV, I'm keeping it until I explicitly give up the control, and then somebody else could take it over.
Yeah, it's kind of a fun little toy, that's for sure. I discovered one thing talking about AirPlay networks, that from best I can tell, iTunes home sharing does not work across VLANs. So if you've got, say, multiple VLANs in your school, AirPlay and Bonjour can work if you've got the right gear, but iTunes home sharing cannot.
Interesting. I wasn't aware of that.
I ran into that. And unless I'm wrong, I ran into that at my house. Redid my home network and put wireless and wired on a separate VLAN. Why? I don't know. I do not need to do that. But as soon as I did and I had the Apple TV hardwired, it did not see my home share, but AirPlay worked. But as soon as I went to Wi-Fi on the Apple TV, it came back up. So that's the best I can tell is what would be causing it.
Useful safety tip.
Another thing, I guess, before we kind of wrap up, this is completely unrelated, but I've been running into an issue on Apple Configurator off and on, and I blogged about this yesterday. When you're syncing paid applications, that you randomly run into an error message that says app not authorized. Unfortunately, it doesn't tell you which app is not authorized, and you will look in your licensing list and not be out of them. You will still have them. It's a very frustrating error. And working with Apple on the phone yesterday, it is a known issue. And it is especially likely to happen if you have libraries over 3 gigabytes of apps. And there's really not an easy way to fix it other than uninstall every application. And you don't have to necessarily do the free ones. It could just be the paid ones, depending on how your makeup is. And then reinstall them one by one until you figure out the one that's causing it. Then the solution is to go back to the volume purchase store, re-download the spreadsheet, not necessarily buy more, but just re-download the spreadsheet and then re-import that into that application's licensing part. You click the little number next to the app to you can re-import it, and that generally will fix it. The thing you don't want to do is find one and assume that you only had one that was a problem, which I did that multiple times. So even if you have 50 of them and you find it on number two is the problem, keep going one by one down through the list and make sure they all work. And it's, again, a known issue internally, and they're working on it. But that kind of leads me to think that there's a lot more going on, I guess, cloud-based with this volume purchase program that meets the eye. If it's constantly pinging back home to check your, I guess, license management.
Yeah, that's, again, useful. I'm planning to spend some time with Apple Configurator quite soon because we're, as we mentioned in previous shows, we're heading towards a refresh, and I'm basically experimenting right now to try and design the exact method of app deployment that we're going to use going forward. We've obviously got such a range of pupils' ages in the school that some of them are going to have the device entirely managed for them, but we're trying to figure out exactly where that cutoff's going to be and who can manage their own device and so on and what we're going to do. So Configurator and I are going to be spending some quality time together over the next few months.
You just let us over here in the U.S. beta test it for you. We work out all the kinks, and it's... Nah, I'm kidding.
Not getting something for a year or so afterwards is not always the baddest thing.
One of the things that Apple did right here that was, I think, really good is that the enterprise support team is the one that handles these kind of calls. So you're not necessarily calling the regular Apple Care or, like your systems engineer. You call enterprise support, and even if you don't have a support agreement, as long as one of the devices you're using, either the computer or one of the iPads or, iPod Touches or iPhones, is still under warranty, they will work with you no problem at all. And so, and they can do remote screen sharing. It's pretty nice. They do a nice job.
It's good to know.
I think that's all I have for the day.
Yeah, we're going to talk next week a little bit more about the state of laptops, the state of Apple laptops specifically. I don't know if I mentioned it at all, but I ordered a new MacBook Air over Christmas. My Core 2 Duo 11-inch MacBook Air is starting to show its age a little bit. So I spent some good time over the holidays looking into exactly the state of play with all of these machines, and it's really a transitional time. It's not absolutely clear cut which is the obvious best laptop for anybody at the moment. There's lots to be said on either side, so we'll talk a little bit about that next week and see where we get to. Hopefully by then I'll actually have my laptop, which would be nice because I'm getting very tight for space on this one, and we'll chat more about that next week.
Again, thanks for our sponsors this week, BDOX Timeline 3D at BDOX.com and MindVault, which you can find out more about MindVault at MindVaultApp.com. We'll have links to all the things we talked about in the show notes at outofschool.net or in your if you're using a podcasting app, they should be in line there. But thanks, everybody, for listening this week, and we'll see you next week.